But the cowboy spit out snuff juice into his little paper cup and disagreed. He told her, a gal out in Los Angeles that was as goddamn good-looking as her, would have to be stupid not to try a career in pictures. Not only that, he told her he liked her chances. Now, if my cousin Sherry wanted to go to Hollywood and be the next Sophia Loren, that would be pie in the sky. But a pretty gal like you, he speculated, I wouldn't be surprised I don't see you acting opposite Tony Curtis for long. As she disappeared into the night, just before she got out of earshot, and he checked himself into the motel, he yelled to her one last note of encouragement. Remember what I said? When you're acting opposite Tony Curtis, you tell him hello from me. The blonde turned around and shouted back to the cowboy, Sure thing, Ace. See you in the movies. She waved one last time and walked off. And when Sharon Tate eventually made her motion picture debut opposite Tony Curtis in the silly comedy Don't Make Waves, she told Tony Curtis, Ace Woody says hello. Chapter 7. Good Morgan, Boss Angeles. Saturday, February 8th, 1969, 6:30 a.m. Cliff's Carmangia drives down the practically deserted street known through the world as the Sunset Strip. For Cliff, this is the start of his working day, driving his car to his boss's house to drive his boss to 20th Century Fox Studios for his 8 o'clock call time. As Cliff pushes the little Volkswagen engine down Sunset Boulevard at 6:30 in the morning, he thinks, New York is a city that never sleeps. Los Angeles, in the middle of the night, and early wee hours of the morning, turns back into the desert it was before it got paved over with concrete. A lone coyote digging through a public garbage pail demonstrates how correct that is. On the car radio, Cliff hears the voice of Robert W. Morgan, the boss tripper, the early morning disc jockey of AM Radio's 93KHJ, yelling to his audience of early risers, Good Morgan, Los Angeles! In the 60s and early 70s, all of Los Angeles pulsed to the beat of 93KHJ. It was known as Boss Radio, and it was known for playing the boss sounds by the boss jocks in Los Angeles. That is, unless you lived in Watts, Compton, or Inglewood. In that case, you pulsed to the soul beat of KJLH. KHJ played the groovy 60s sounds of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Monkees, Paul Revere, and the Raiders, the Mamas and the Papas, the Box Tops, the Love and Spoonful, as well as later forgotten groups of the era like the Royal Guardsmen, the Buchanan Brothers, Tom Paul and the Glazier Brothers, the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, the Ohio Express, the Mojo Men, the Love Generation, and others of their ilk. Plus, the station had an all-star lineup of disc jockeys, including, along with Morgan, Sam Riddle, Bobby Tripp, Humble Harv, who, like Cliff, would later kill his wife, but Harv wouldn't get away with it, Johnny Williams, Charlie Tuna, and the number one disc jockey in America, the real Don Steele. Also, Robert W. Morgan, Sam Riddle, and Don Still all had local Los Angeles music shows on KHJ TV Channel 9. Morgan hosted Groovy, Riddle hosted Boss City, and Steele had, naturally, the real Don Steele show. The KHJ radio and TV stations dominated the market with their zeitgeist sounds, crazy promotional contests, wild station-sponsored concerts, and a genuine sense of humor emanating from their on-air cast of cut-ups. Sam Riddle would greet his 9 a.m. till noon listeners with his catchphrase, Hello, music lovers! And the real Don Steele would constantly remind his listeners that Tina Delgado is alive, his most popular and never-explained running joke. As Cliff drives up one of the residential hills of Hollywood, while Robert W. Morgan's live commercial for Tanya Tanning Butter blends into the melodic doo-doo-doo opening of Simon and Garfunkel's ubiquitous top 40 hit, Mrs. Robinson, He sees four young hippie girls, age ranged 16 to early 20s, cross the neighborhood street in front of his car at a stop sign. The girls look dirty, and not just normal unbathed hippie dirt, but like they've been having an orgy in a garbage pail. All the young ladies seem to be lugging some bundles of food. One girl carries a crate of cabbage heads, another three packages of hot dog buns, still another cradles a bunch of carrots. But the fourth, a sexy, tall, thin, bushy-haired brunette flower child type in a crochet halter top, short cut-off jeans that show off her long, dirty white legs, and filthy big bare feet, waddles in caboose position of this hippie chick train, lugging a big round jar of giant green pickles as if it were a papoose. The dirty brunette beauty glances in Cliff's direction and sees him through the windshield of the rumbling Carmangia. A smile spreads across her pretty face in the blonde dude's direction. Cliff smiles back. The brunette hoists the pickle jar up to one arm by her right breast, leaving the other arm free to flash the Carmangia driver the peace sign with her two fingers. Cliff holds up two fingers, flashing it back. They share a moment together. Then the moment's over. She's on the other side of the street, and the filthy female's baby elephant walk their way down the residential sidewalk. Cliff watches hippie pickle girl from behind as she walks away, willing her to take one glance back at him. One, two, three, he counts in his head. Then she takes one more look back at him over her shoulder. Victory. He smiles to her and himself and presses down on the gas pedal with his moccasin-covered foot and zooms uphill. 6:45 a.m. When Rick's clock radio wakes him up to the voice of 93KHJ's morning disc jockey Robert W. Morgan, he immediately feels that his pillow is soaked cold with alcohol sweat. Today will be his first day of work on a new CBS Western pilot named Lancer. Naturally, he plays the heavy. A kidnapping, cold-blooded, murdering leader of a bunch of cattle rustlers, which the script refers to as land pirates. It's a pretty good script, and a darn good part. Even though Rick thinks he should be playing the series lead, Johnny Lancer. Rick inquired, who got the part? It's some fella named James Stacy, who had guested on A Good Gunsmoke, that CBS decided to give a show of his own. The other regulars are rugged, horse-faced Andrew Duggan as the father, Murdoch Lancer, and Wayne Maunder, who recently starred in a canceled series on ABC about Custer, as the other brother, Scott Lancer. The script is not only good, but he has good dialogue, including a lot of dialogue on the first day. So he was up late last night, running lines with his tape recorder. He usually does that floating in his swimming pool in his floaty chair while he smokes and drinks whiskey sours. He makes the whiskey sours and pours them into one of the German beer steins from his German beer stein collection. How many did I have? He thinks as he lies in bed, nursing a hangover that feels closer to polio and a belly full of last night's booze. The beer stein holds two bar-sized whiskey sour cocktails. How many steins? Four. Four? Four. That's when he vomited all over himself in his bed. Most actors and actresses of the 60s had a couple of cocktails or glasses of wine to wind down with once they got home. But Rick turned a couple of whiskey sours at the end of the day into eight whiskey sours till he blacked out. Rick had no memory of leaving the pool or taking his clothes off or climbing into bed. He just woke up in bed with no idea of how he got there. He looks down at the disgusting mess he's made of himself, then glances at the clock radio beside the bed. It reads 6:52. Cliff's going to be here in about 20 minutes, so he better get his shit together. The bad part about barfing on yourself when you wake up in the morning is you feel like a disgusting, pig, pathetic loser. The good part is, without all that poison sloshing around in your belly, you feel much better. What Rick didn't know, and wouldn't know for years, is he suffered from a condition that was not commonly known at the time. Since high school, Rick had experienced violent mood swings. His blues were bluer than most, and his highs could border on manic. But since completion of the Universal four-picture deal, and specifically Salty, the talking sea otter, his downswings seemed to find a deeper basement than before, especially alone at home at night, when loneliness, boredom, and self-pity combined to create a toxic self-detest fest, with whiskey sour cocktails his only form of relief-inducing medication. 7 months later, Rick returned from the Marvin Schwartz arranged trip to Italy with a brand spanking new Italian wife. He would get a call from his old mentor, director, Paul Wendkos. They hadn't talked in 3 years, and Rick was glad to hear from him. "Hello?" Rick said into the phone receiver. "Dalton, you old sack! It's Wendkos." "Hey, Paul, how you doing?" "How am I doing? How the hell are you doing?" Wendkos said. "I heard some fucking hippies busted in your place, and you went all Mike Lewis on them." Rick gave a humble, no big deal kind of laugh and said, "All I did was realize the distance between me and Mike Lewis. He kills 150 Nazis and doesn't change his expression. I torched one small hippie girl and I practically shit my pants." "Well, honestly, Rick," Paul said, "when Lewis killed those guys and his expression didn't change, that wasn't because he was so brave. It was because you can't act." They both laughed it up on each side of the phone. What Wendkos was referring to, no sooner did Rick and his new bride arrive from Rome to his house in Benedict Canyon than three hippies, two girls and a guy, broke into his home brandishing butcher knives and a pistol threatening his family. Rick and Cliff made short order of the housebreakers, killing all three in a brutal fight. Cliff, in the living room, protecting Rick's new wife, Francesca, bashed in the faces of the guy and one of the girls. Rick, who was in his floaty chair in the swimming pool at the time of the attack, was almost shot by the hippie girl with the pistol. He later told authorities, "That goddamn hippie almost blew my fucking head off." And in a scene straight out of Wendkos's picture, The 14 Fists of McCluskey, Rick set the assailant on fire with a practice flamethrower left over from McCluskey, which he had in his tool shed. "I burnt that goddamn hippie to a crisp," he later told his neighbor. What the armed intruders' intentions were was never made clear, but their intentions sounded both deadly and evil. When Cliff asked the male intruder what he wanted, the young man invoked Satan, saying, "I'm the devil, and I've come here to do the devil's business." The LAPD theorized the hippie intruders were frying on acid and were out to perform a satanic ritual. What isn't a matter of theory is, those fucking hippies sure picked the wrong house. The next day, Rick's adventures hit the news, and it became the talk of the town. It went from local news to the network evening news, and finally, the world. Something about Jay Cahill killing three long-haired hippie bad guys with his flamethrower from the 14 Fists of McCluskey just seized the imagination. Till pretty soon the whole ghastly night of violence became heavy with symbolic weight, turning Rick, the former TV cowboy, into a folkloric hero of Nixon's silent majority. All this newfound attention wasn't lost on the industry either. Shortly afterward, Dalton was offered a guest star gig on one of the biggest shows on TV, Bruce Geller's Mission Impossible. After the flamethrower incident, TV Guy did an inside profile on him, his third profile in the magazine, and he was asked to appear for the first time on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. Rick proved a big hit in Johnny's guest chair, and throughout the 70s, Carson had him back on whenever Dalton had a film role, TV movie, high-profile guest shot, or new series to promote. Dalton later confessed to his buddy Cliff, All in all, those goddamn hippies did me a favor. Paul Wenkos wasn't just calling Rick up to shoot the shit. He was making the phone call that every actor wants to get. He was calling about Rick's availability. The director was just about to start filming a World War II programmer based out of England and to be shot in Malta. And not only had the hippie flamethrower incident raised Dalton's profile, but it also raised the profile of the Wenkos film, The 14 Fists of McCluskey. Wenkos was preparing a film for a small British production company called Oakmont Productions, which had an international distribution deal through MGM. Oakmont specialized in modestly budgeted World War II action-adventure vehicles featuring British casts, except for the lead, who was usually an American actor known from television. Some examples were Boris Segal's The Thousand Plane Raid starring Christopher Rat Patrol George, Mosquito Squadron starring David, Man from Uncle McCullum, Billy Graham, Submarine X-1, starring a pre-Godfather, post-Eldorado James Caan, Walter Grauman's The Last Escape, starring Stuart Cimarron Strip Whitman, and Wenkos's Attack on the Iron Coast, starring Lloyd C. Hunt Bridges. Wenkos was gearing up to do one more, a Navy-based adventure with the pulpy title Hellboats. The movie was initially set to star the blonde television actor James, Mr. Novak, Franciscus, but when Franciscus's starring role in 20th Century Fox's Beneath the Planet of the Apes went over schedule, Wenkos was forced to go looking for another TV famous American. And just like he did on McCluskey when he lost Fabian due to a broken shoulder, Wenkos thought of Rick Dalton. So the next thing Rick knew, he and Cliff were on a plane flying to London, then Malta, for a 5-week shoot on Hellboats. All the Oakmont productions were pretty much the same, with Mosquito Squadron and Attack on the Iron Coast being the pick of the litter. But for what they weren't bad. They were pretty entertaining, if unmemorable, potboilers. When Hellboats played theatrically in America in 1970, it was on the lower half of a double feature with Phil Hellfire Texas Carlson's exciting Italian-made World War II action flick, Hornet's Nest, with Rock Hudson and Silva Koshina, which pretty much had the exact same story as The 14 Fists of McCluskey, except instead of Rod Taylor leading a gang of brutes to blow up a dam and flood a Nazi stronghold, it was Rock Hudson leading a band of war orphan children to blow up a dam and flood a Nazi stronghold. All in all, a pretty entertaining night at the movies in 1970. Along with another lead role in a studio production, Hellboats offered Dalton a chance to reestablish his relationship with director and mentor Paul Wenkos, and Wenkos wasted no time plugging Dalton into his next picture. A few years earlier, when Wenkos was making for the Mersch Company, the third of their Magnificent Seven movies, he wanted Dalton for what in essence was the McQueen part. But since Rick was stuck over at Universal working alongside an aquatic rodent, he had to pass. Wenkos did such a good job with that assignment, the Mersch Company offered Paul the fourth film in the series, at the time titled Cannons for the Magnificent Seven. The script was written by Stephen Candle, who also wrote Wenkos' film Battle of the Coral Sea, which was where Dalton first worked with the filmmaker. The script deals with the character of Chris, Yul Brynner in the first two films, and George Kennedy in Wenkos' third flick, and his six other compadres fighting a Mexican bandit who poses as a revolutionary named Cordoba. Cordoba's army is 100 men strong, and he has 6 cannons he swiped from the United States military. Chris and his Magnificent Seven, sent by none other than General John J. Pershing, were to go into Mexico, infiltrate Cordoba's impenetrable fortress, destroy the cannons, capture Cordoba, and bring him back to the United States to stand trial. Like General Pershing tells Chris, sounding similar to one of Jim Phelps' self-destructing tapes on Mission Impossible, "If you agree to go, you'll be without authority, without orders, without uniforms. If you're caught, you'll be shot." The whole story has a Western Mission Impossible vibe, which shouldn't be surprising since Kendall was the head story editor on that series at that time. When Kendall was writing his script, he just assumed Big George Kennedy would be reprising his role as team leader Chris. All through the screenplay, his prose kept referring to Chris's behemoth-like stature. But once the writer turned the script to the Marish brothers, they liked it so much they figured they could do better than George Kennedy. Instead, they offered the film to George Peppard. Peppard responded to the material, but with a caveat. He'd be damned if he was going to be the third guy in the fourth Magnificent Seven film to play Chris. So, he instructed them to lose the Magnificent Seven connection and name his character anything other than Chris. Kendall rewrote the script, and Peppard's character went from Chris to Rod. And the team went from the Magnificent Seven to the Magnificent Five. And the title was changed to Canon for Cordoba. When Coase offered Dalton the part of the second most important team member, Jackson Harkness. However, this time the second lieutenant role wasn't a McQueen copy. Rod and Jackson shared a similar dynamic with Gregory Peck and Anthony Quinn in The Guns of Navarone. Dalton's Jackson blames Peppard's Rod, his former friend, for the death of his brother. While Rick's character agrees to go on the mission to Mexico to destroy Cordoba and his cannons, Jackson vows to kill Rod, if they live through it. While all through the 60s it bugged Dalton to be in McQueen's shadow, it really stuck a weed up his ass to be in Peppard's. However, by this late date, the two former swinging dicks had been sufficiently humbled. The two men got along in Mexico, both on screen and off. They matched up well together, and the antagonistic dynamic between them had real power. In fact, Peppard later got Dalton to guest on his TV series, Banachek. But it was another actor in Canon for Cordoba that Rick really hit it off with. Pete Duell was a handsome 31-year-old actor who had already acted in two television series. He played Gidget's brother-in-law opposite Sally Field on Gidget, and he starred in a sitcom titled Love on a Rooftop, alongside Burt Reynolds' wife, Judy Carn. He was part of the team's Magnificent Five. 2 years later, he would become an exciting TV star on his hit Western series on ABC, Alias Smith and Jones, a TV series knockoff of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but a really, really good knockoff. Dalton and Duell on location in Mexico both enjoyed drinking tequila, chasing Mexican poutang, bitching about Hollywood, and each other's company. But they shared something else. Something neither knew intellectually, but both sensed internally. Both Dalton and Duell were undiagnosed bipolar, and drinking alcohol was their only form of self-medication. But since neither man knew this, to them their drinking was a sign of internal weakness. But Pete Duell was far worse than Rick, culminating with, at the height of his Alias Smith and Jones success, Pete Duell shooting himself in the middle of the night. The whole town wondered why Duell did it. But Rick, in his heart of hearts, felt he knew the answer. After Duell's death in 1971, Dalton would do the hard work it took to not lean so heavily on booze. By 1973, when Dalton shot the revenge western The Deadly Trackers opposite Richard Harris in Durango, Mexico, both men, heavy drinkers, had reached an equilibrium while on location. They stayed off the sauce Monday through Thursday. But starting on Friday night into Sunday afternoon, the two men drank enough tequila, sangria, margaritas, and Bloody Marys to float a boat. As Rick looks into his bathroom mirror, putting the final touches on his pompadour, he hears Cliff's Carmen Gia zoom up into his driveway. He looks at the watch on his wrist, 7:15 on the dot. While barfing when he woke up initially made him feel better, it didn't clean out his pipes completely. There's still enough of last night's old booze swirling around in his stomach to keep his belly feeling ill, his face sweaty, and his complexion a little green. He's just going to have to nurse coffee and smoke cigarettes till about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. But Jesus Christ, Rick thinks, that's 7 hours from now. I bet James fucking Stacy ain't starting his first day on his new TV show hungover as fuck. He looks at himself in the bathroom mirror and says out loud, "And you fucking wonder why CBS is starring him in a new series and not you? Because they think that prick's got potential. The only potential you got is potentially fucking up your life." Cliff knocks on his front door. Rick yells from the bathroom, "Yeah, I'm coming." Takes one more look at the pathetic fuck-up in his bathroom mirror. "Don't you worry, Rick," he says intimately to his reflection. "It's the first day. It's gonna take them a while to get their shit together. Just take it one cup of coffee at a time." Then putting on his show must go on face, he pumps himself up by saying Jackie Gleason's catchphrase at the time. "And away we go." Before he exits the bathroom, he spits in the sink, then looks down and sees a little red blood mixed in with the saliva. Rick examines the spit wad closer and asks, "Now what?" 7:10 a.m. Squeaky's filthy petite bare feet pad their way across the dirty cracked linoleum floor of George's kitchen, over the dusty wood boards of the living room, and down the matted carpet of the hallway leading to George's bedroom at the end of the corridor. She knocks on the door and says cheerfully, "Good morning." She hears the bed springs squeak as the old man rustles awake. Then after a moment, she hears his grumpy voice come from the other side of the door. "Yeah?" she asks. "Can I come in, George?" Old man Spawn has his de rigueur morning coughing fit. Then says a phlegmy, "Come in, sweetheart." She twists the doorknob and steps inside the 80-year-old man's stuffy bedroom. George, lying under the covers in his bed, turns in the young girl's direction. Squeaky leans against the doorframe, balances her right foot against her left knee, and tells the old man, "Good morning, honey. I've got eggs cooking on the stove. Do you want Jimmy Dean sausage or Farmer John bacon?" "Jimmy Dean," says the old man. She continues with her questions. "Do you want to eat breakfast casual and comfortable, or would you like me to help you get dressed and make you all handsome?" George thinks about it for a moment, then decides, "I think I'd like to get dressed." A smile breaks across her pixie-ish face. "Aw, you're trying to steal my heart, getting all spruced up." "Stop it," George grunts. She instructs him, "Lay back down for a second, honey. I'll take the eggs off the stove and come back and get you looking all sharp," Squeaky adds. "You'll melt all the girls' hearts, you handsome devil." "Stop teasing me, honey," George whines. "Oh, you love it," Squeaky flirts, as she heads up the hallway through the living room and into the kitchen, removing the bubbling eggs in the frying pan from the stove burner. She walks over to the General Electric radio plugged into the wall on the kitchen counter and switches it on. Barbara Fairchild's heartbreaking novelty country hit, "The Teddy Bear Song," fills the kitchen. "I wish I had button eyes and a red felt nose, shaggy cotton skin, and just one set of clothes. Sitting on a shelf in a local department store, with no dreams to dream and nothing to be sorry for." Whenever George is awake, the radio is always playing KZLA, Los Angeles's country music station. "I wish I was a teddy bear, not living nor loving or going nowhere. I wish I was a teddy bear, and I'm wishing that I hadn't fallen in love with you." It's been Squeaky's job to take care of this blind old man for the last few months. The man who leads her commune, Charlie, impressed on her how important her job was. After their family had moved all around Los Angeles like a nomadic tribe for months, George Spawn's old western set and ranch finally offered them a home. A home from which they could lay down roots and test Charlie's societal theories, expand their numbers, And who knows? Hopefully create a new world order. She was to be the old man's cook, his nurse, his friendly companion, and, if she wouldn't mind masturbating him every once in a while, that would go a long way to securing the family's position on the ranch. Or as Charlie said as he broke the news to the 21-year-old, "Sometimes, kiddo, you gotta take one for the team." The night Charlie told her she was going to have to jack this old man off periodically and maybe do even more than that was the only time during her tenure with Charles Manson that she ever considered hightailing it back to San Francisco and maybe patching things up with her parents. But then a funny thing happened that Squeaky could never have foreseen. She fell in love with this blind old bastard. Not Romeo and Juliet type of love, but a deep love nevertheless. This grouchy old bastard wasn't really a bastard at all. He was just lonely and forgotten. The industry that used his ranch to make their B-Westerns and TV shows for 4 decades had forgotten him. His family had forgotten him, leaving him to die in a dilapidated rat trap amongst horseshit and hay. Squeaky offered the old man the one thing that his socked-away money couldn't buy: a loving touch, a sweet voice, and a sensitive ear. When Squeaky told George, or anybody else, she loved the old man, that wasn't just hippie sing-song. That was Squeaky sincerely expressing her inner emotions about the old man it was her pleasure to look after. When she returns to the bedroom, she helps the blind old man get into a crisp, white, Western-style shirt. Then she does up the little buttons. She holds out some tan slacks that he steps into one leg at a time. The young caretaker ties a Western bolo tie around his stiff shirt collar and combs the wispy white hair on his head with a brush. Then, taking him by the wrist and elbow, she assists him through the house toward the kitchen table. As they make their way at George's slow, steady pace, Squeaky tells him, "Now see, you look so handsome. I'm such a lucky girl that you always want to look so attractive for me."
"Stop teasing me," George Mock complains.
"Who's teasing?" Squeaky asks. "You know, breakfast tastes better when you put in the effort to take care of yourself."
She eases the old man into a chair at the kitchen table. She lays her hands on his stooped shoulders and asks in his ear, "Sanka or Postum?"
"Postum," says George.
"I swear you're going to turn into a cup of Postum, Squeaky kids. Now, I started making scrambled eggs because that's what I made lately. But maybe you're getting tired of that and would like something different."
"You mean like scrambled eggs and carnitas?" George asks.
"No," Squeaky smiles. "I was thinking more like you want scrambled or sunny side up."
The old man thinks a moment and says,
"Sunny side up."
She kisses him on the top of his head and goes about fixing his breakfast. On KZLA, a Save-On radio commercial plays out of the speaker. "Join the Save-On hit parade. On all these items you can save. Save-On drugstore. Save-On drugstore. Boom, boom, boom. Save-On!" The redhead takes a jar of Postum, a cheap coffee-flavored substitute that old people like, down from the kitchen cabinet. The powder in the jar has dried as solid as a rock. She has to stab it with the handle of the spoon to break off a chunk. She drops the rock of Postum into George's coffee cup and pours hot water on it. She puts the cup down in front of George and places his hands on the handle, warning him, "Be careful, it's hot."
"You say that every morning," says George.
"It's hot every morning," says Squeaky.
She drops 2 new eggs into a piping hot skillet coated with melted, bubbling butter. She cuts off 3 pieces of Jimmy Dean pure pork sausage from the cookie dough-like plastic container into another frying pan. They sizzle. With a spatula, Squeaky moves the 2 sunny-side-up eggs onto a breakfast plate. After adding the sausages, Squeaky places the plate in front of George.
"Would you like me to cut up your sausage and bust your yolk for you?"
George makes an affirmative grunt. Squeaky squatting down with a knife and fork, Squeaky cuts up the round sausage patties into bite-sized pieces, then takes George's fork and busts one yellow yolk, then the other. "Okay, you're ready to go," she informs him, then throws her arms around his neck from behind and whispers into his ear, "Enjoy, darling. It was made with love." She kisses him on the side of his head and pads out of the room to let George eat his breakfast in peace. On KZLA, Sunny Jane sings the folkloric love story of Running Bear. Running Bear loved little white dove with a love big as the sky. Running Bear loved little white dove with a love that couldn't die. 7:30 a.m. J. Sebring, the man responsible for creating a revolution in men's hair design, and whose preeminence in Hollywood hairstyling is undisputed, lies in his bed in his black silk pajamas, watching the Hanna-Barbera cartoon adventure show, Johnny Quest. On the television screen, Johnny's turban-wearing sidekick, Haji, is casting one of his mystic spells using his magic word, Sim Sim Salabim. A slight tap on Jay's closed bedroom door gets his attention. "Yes, Raymond," Jay calls to the knocker. A voice with a proper British accent calls from behind the boudoir barrier. "Ready for your morning coffee, sir?" Scooching up to a sitting position, Jay calls back, "Yes, I am. Come in." The bedroom door opens and Raymond, Jay's British gentleman's gentleman, dressed in classic butler attire and carrying in both hands a silver service breakfast in bed tray, enters the room with a cheerful, "Good morning, Master Sebring." "Good morning, Raymond," Jay replies. Crossing the room towards the man in bed, Raymond inquires, "Did you enjoy yourself yesterday evening, sir?"
"Yes, I did," Jay answers. "Thank you for asking."
The butler places the tray in front of his master, and Jay examines the service set before him. It contains a chic silver coffee pot, a china teacup on a saucer, a bowl of sugar cubes, a miniature silver pitcher of heavy cream, a warm croissant on a plate, a dish with a pat of butter, a collection of different flavored jams in tiny jars, and one long-stem red rose in a skinny silver vase.
"Everything looks delish," says the young man. "What's for breakfast this morning?"
As Raymond walks to the big picture window and throws open the blackout curtains, flooding the dark room with sudden sunlight, he says, "I was thinking of a nice savory salmon scramble with a side of cottage cheese and half a grapefruit."
Jay makes a face and says, "That might be too much for me this morning. We had a late night of chili burgers at Tommy's last night." Now it's Raymond's turn to make a face.
The butler has the same regard for Jay ending his night with Tommy's chili burgers as he does when his master starts his day with a big bowl of Cap'n Crunch. And he responds to this new information with droll sarcasm.
Well, in that case, with the chili burger still digesting in your belly, I can't imagine you want to have a savory anything."
Raymond leaves the picture window and returns to his master's bedside and asks, "Shall I pour the coffee, sir?" Jay nods his head and says,
"That would be nice, Raymond."
Raymond lifts up the silver coffee pot and pours the java into the china teacup, as he says, "Very well, sir. Why don't we change that half a grapefruit into a small glass of grapefruit juice?" The butler lifts the small pitcher of half and half and pours it into the teacup and asks, "And shall we continue with coffee or possibly move on to a hot chocolate?" As Jay ponders this decision, Raymond lifts a tiny spoon off the tray and stirs the cream into the java until it turns the color that Master Sebring prefers.
"I think hot chocolate,"
Jay announces with aplomb. Then with equal theatricality, Raymond says, "Then hot chocolate it is. Would you care to remain in bed watching cartoons? Or should the hot chocolate precipitate a change in venue?" Jay puts on his thinking face and ponders. Well, I was watching Johnny Quest. But we could. Looking up at his valet, he inquires, "What do you think, Raymond?" "Well," Raymond says, gesturing toward the bright morning sunshine outside his window, "as you can see for yourself, it's a very sunny, pleasant California morning. If one lived in London and was fortunate enough to wake up on a day like this, one wouldn't stay in bed and watch cartoons. A day this nice, you wouldn't even go into work. So may I suggest hot chocolate in your garden so you can thoroughly enjoy it?" Then adding, "You know how you do love your morning beverage with the ghost of Jean Harlow in the garden." The house that Jay bought 3 years ago was once owned by Jean Harlow and her director husband, Paul Byrne, in the 30s, and they both died there. And Jay insists that the ghosts of Jean and Paul haunt the house. Even his ex-fiancée, Sharon Tate, believes she witnessed something mysterious and spooky one night. "Raymond," Jay grandly proclaims, "you've convinced me. I'll have hot chocolate under the sun in the garden." To which Raymond replies, "Splendid." 7:45 a.m. Roman Polanski steps out into his Hollywood Hills home backyard and the vivid view of downtown L.A. it offers its successful residents. The diminutive Polanski sports bedhead on his cranium, a silk robe across his shoulders, and in one hand an empty coffee cup, and in the other a French press coffee pot. As he putters across the wet grass of his backyard, his hard plastic slippers make pop, pop sounds against his bare heels. He's followed eagerly by Dr. Saperstein, his wife's little Yorkshire Terrier named after the sinister pediatrician that Ralph Bellamy played in Roman's film Rosemary's Baby. Later that year, when Sharon was away in Montreal making a movie, Roman's old friend and house guest, Wojtek Fakowski, would accidentally kill Dr. Saperstein by running over the little dog while backing his car out of the driveway. Roman was in his office working on the script for his next movie, The Day of the Dolphin, when Wojtek appeared in his doorway. "Roman," Wojtek sheepishly said. Polanski turned around in his chair to face his old friend. Wojtek admitted, "I think I just accidentally killed Sharon's dog." Roman's face exploded like a bad actor in a silent movie. "You killed Dr. Saperstein?" Roman was out of his chair and rushed by his friend, lamenting with panic anxiety, "Oh my God, what have you done?" When the director reached the open front door, he saw the little hairy body lying dead in the car park in front of their house. His hands went to his head and he began pacing in circles, saying to Wojtek in Polish, "Oh my God, what have you done? What have you done?" Wojtek felt a little bad, but he didn't expect Roman to react like this. In Polish, he said, "I'm sorry, Roman, it was an accident." Roman spun around to face him, screaming in Polish, "You know what you've done. You've ruined my fucking life. She loves this dog." "Don't worry," Wojtek assured him. "I'll tell her it was my fault." Roman yelled in response, "No, you won't tell her. She'll never forgive you." Roman tried to explain Americans to his Polish friend. "Don't you understand? She's an American. Americans love their fucking dogs more than they love their children. You might as well have dropped her fucking baby down the stairs." Sharon never did learn what really happened to Dr. Saperstein. In order to save his friend the wrath and scorn of the Texas-born army brat, Roman told Sharon that Dr. Saperstein ran away and must have either gotten lost or run afoul of a coyote. Alone in her hotel room on location in Montreal, Sharon cried all night long. But today, Dr. Saperstein is still alive. And when the little dog comes running up to Roman with a little red ball in his mouth, he wants the little man to play with him. Roman presses down on the French press plunger and ignores the dog. Roman's a little grumpy this morning. like his next-door neighbor Rick Dalton, who he's never met. He's a little hungover as well, but unlike Rick, it's not due to a night of heavy drinking by himself. Last night, Roman and Sharon, along with friends Jay Sebring and Michelle Phillips and Cass Elliott, went to a party at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion. Then afterwards, they went someplace else around 3 a.m. to eat disgusting chili hamburgers amongst sketchy L.A. types. Mexicans in their uniform street clothes and outrageously painted cars alongside white biker hoodlums on their noisy motorcycles. In Europe, they'd end the night with fine cognac and Cuban cigars or a late-night wine cellar and finish off the evening with a 20-year-old Bordeaux. But these childish Americans think it's cool to end the night with oily chili burgers and Coca-Cola. Not only that, but Roman was also pretty sure nobody liked those fat, greasy burgers. He's positive Sharon didn't, though she'd never admit it. But naturally, everybody acted like they were having the best time in the world. Sharon tried to even order a hamburger without chili, and Jay wouldn't hear of it. So Sharon gave in to the peer pressure, saying, "Fine, fine, fine," telling the man behind the counter wearing the paper hat, "I'll have a chili burger," which sat in her stomach like a cannonball, making her feel ill the whole ride back to Cielo Drive. Roman loved his American friends, but was always a little surprised at the juvenile things they took delight in, or in this case, pretended to take delight in. Not only that, but he also had to make nice with that asshole Steve McQueen most of the night. Roman and McQueen don't like each other. But since Steve is one of Sharon's oldest friends in Los Angeles, they tolerate each other. It's obvious Sharon and McQueen fucked before. He's never confirmed this with Sharon, but he knows McQueen's the kind of guy who wouldn't still be Sharon's friend if he hadn't fucked her a few times in the past. Normally that wouldn't bother Roman. Jay was engaged to Sharon, they fucked all the time. And Roman has some sexual past with more than half the women in his orbit. But McQueen makes a point of it by the way he smirks at Roman. Every glance of those blue eyes and grin of that little mouth seem to say, "I fucked your wife." Also, Roman doesn't like the way McQueen manhandles Sharon. Like picking the big blonde up off her feet and spinning her around till she goes, "Wee!" like a little girl. Activities that Roman is physically too small to do, and McQueen knows that. And that's why McQueen does it. The guy's just an asshole, Roman thinks. After being purposely ignored for the last 20 seconds, the little dog barks to get the little man's attention. "This fucking dog," Roman thinks. "I can't even enjoy a cup of coffee in peace without this little tyrant spoiling it." He throws the ball and the little dog runs after it. Roman doesn't hate Dr. Saperstein like he hates Steve McQueen. He's just grouchy this morning. One, because he's hungover. And two, because Sharon woke him up. You see, Sharon snores. Chapter 8. Lancer. Pulled by 6 horses, the Butterfield Wells Fargo passenger stagecoach rounded the corner where the adobe-walled mission stood and thundered down the dusty dirt main drag of the Spanish-style town of Royo del Oro, 60 miles on the north side of the Mexican border in California. The hard hooves of the sweaty beasts tore at the dirt main street, creating a cloud of brown powder in their wake. Monty Armbruster, the white-haired 40-year veteran of the Butterfield line, pulled on the leather reins in his gloved hands, yanking the horses' heads back from the bits embedded in their mouths, making the 6 powerful equines come to a gentle stop directly in front of the Hotel Lancaster. With his light Texas twang, Monty sang out, "Royal Del Oro, last stop!" The backlit sunshine rays filter through the gauze-like brown dust in the way 100 years from now all cinematographers of Western movies would hope to duplicate. 8-year-old Mirabella Lancer, the short in stature but wise for her years daughter of Murdoch Lancer, the owner and operator of the biggest cattle ranch in the territory, leaped off the wooden barrel she had been perched on. In excited anticipation, she turned to the Mexican vaquero, who was only a few inches taller than her but sported a comically large sombrero on top of his head, and chirped, "Come on, Ernesto!" Taking the child's hand, the vaquero Ernesto led the young girl down the main street of the town toward the Butterfield stagecoach. Since her father was the richest man in the territory, Mirabella had known every business owner in Royo del Oro, since she was old enough to say anything more meaningful than "goo-goo," resulting in a series of smiles and waves as she made her way down the business district of the town. A horse-drawn wagon piled high with wooden barrels of beer passed in front of her and the little vaquero. They stopped on the wooden walkway till the beer wagon cleared their path. Crossing the dirt street, approaching the stagecoach from behind, Mirabella prepared herself for her first glimpse of either of the two brothers she'd never known. Her father's long-lost sons had both sent word they would soon be traveling to Lancer Ranch. However, which brother was going to step off the Butterfield stagecoach was a mystery to both her and Murdoch Lancer's ranch hand Ernesto. The ranch had received a wire indicating that the son of Murdoch Lancer had climbed aboard a Butterfield stagecoach leaving Tucson, Arizona, 2 days ago, and, minus any hardships, should be arriving in Royo del Oro around 12 this afternoon. Not included in the wire was which son exactly was arriving. Unlike a train, a stagecoach arriving 3 hours later than scheduled was practically on time. So it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the Butterfield stagecoach stopped in front of the Hotel Lancaster. Mirabella and Ernesto stood in the street, waiting for the stagecoach door to open and see which of her brothers would emerge. Both brothers were born on the Lancer Ranch, but neither had met the other. And neither had seen their cattle ranching father since they were small children. Like Mirabella, both of Murdoch Lancer's sons were the product of different deceased mothers. Scott Foster Lancer, who was raised by his mother, Diane Foster Lancer Axelrod's wealthy family in Boston, was a Harvard graduate and an ex-military man, having ridden with the British cavalry in India, the Bengal Lancers. Murdoch's other son, Johnny Lancer, was raised in Mexico by his mother, Marta Conchita Luisa Galvadon Lancer. Marta had no family in Mexico, wealthy or otherwise. The only money Marta made was made dancing and fucking and playing castanets in a series of cantinas throughout half the cutthroat hamlet south of the border. Johnny's whole childhood, he thought sex was something men paid women to do, like dance or sing, cook food, or wash their clothes. Scott's mother, Diane, retreated to her Beacon Hill family back east when it became apparent that life on a cattle ranch, surrounded by horseshit, cowshit, cowboys, and Mexicans, was not for her or her baby boy. Scott was 3 years old when he boarded the Royo del Oro stage out of town. Johnny was younger than Scott, but older when he left the Lancer Ranch. He lived with his father and his mother at the ranch until he was 10. Then one dark, rainy night, with her 10-year-old son in tow, Marta climbed aboard a fancy buggy that Murdoch had purchased her for her birthday and rode it 60 miles across the border into Mexico. And that was the last time little John ever saw Murdoch Lancer, the sprawling Lancer Ranch, the opulent Lancer Ranch house, and the town of Royo del Oro. Johnny went from being the son of the wealthiest man in the valley, being taught his school learning by a private tutor, eating the best black Angus on china plates prepared by a French chef and sleeping on a feather bed, to being the son of a Mexican whore who existed on beans and hardtack served on clay plates, who drank cactus juice the way he used to drink milk, who ate jerky the way he used to eat peppermint sticks, who was taught dirty jokes by motherfuckers, slept on sacks of coffee beans in the back of cantinas, and learned how to defend himself against both rat attacks and molestation-minded prairie scum in the middle of the night. Until in one of those cutthroat hamlets, a wealthy, dissatisfied customer from Mexico City cut Marta's throat. Johnny was 12 years old when he dug the hole in the hard-packed dirt that he buried his mother in. The rich man stood trial for the murder of his mother and was acquitted by a biased jury. 2 years later, Johnny killed the man who murdered his mother. And even though it took him a decade, he eventually killed every member of that crooked jury as well. Johnny never knew why his mother spirited him off in the middle of that wet night, but he could guess. He guessed Murdoch Lancer got tired of playing house with a Mexican chili pepper and her half-greaser son. So one night he told her to vamos. Johnny knew if he ever went back to the Lancer ranch, he'd blow his father's fucking head off for throwing him and his mother out in the rain. But he also knew Murdoch Lancer was a very important white American. And if he shot his father, Johnny Lancer would eventually hang by the neck for it. Luckily, Murdoch wasn't going anywhere. It's one of the few drawbacks to being a wealthy landowner. Anyone who wants you can find you. Johnny put his mother in the ground, and one day he'd do the same for his father. And if the cost of avenging his mother was to be the forfeiture of his life, so be it. Still, Johnny was in no hurry to forfeit his life. That rich bastard could wait. In the meantime, there was gold to be stolen, pussy to be laid, and tequila to be guzzled. So imagine Johnny's surprise when a telegram showed up at the Hotel Felix, a contact place where he received job offers, usually of the nefarious type. In care of Johnny Lancer, stop. Job offer, stop. Travel to Lancer Ranch outside of Rio del Oro, California. Stop. Pay $1,000 upon arrival. Stop. Payment for consideration of job offer. Stop. No obligation. Stop. Murdoch Lancer. Along with the telegram was a wire for $50 to pay for the passage to Rio del Oro. Fuck me swinging, thought Johnny. But the real lure wasn't the offer of $1,000. It was the opportunity. After all these years, to look in the face of Murdoch Lancer, the man who made a money-grubbing whore out of his mother and blow his brains out of the back of his skull. Mirabella Lancer caught her breath as a Butterfield stagecoach door finally opened and out stepped a fancy black-and-white spat shoe onto the footwell. Her eyes widened as a very handsome, blonde-haired man emerged from the passenger coach, dressed in the fanciest, bluest clothes she'd ever seen on a man. Having been raised on a cattle ranch, she was used to the attire of men who worked for a living. Even when the businessmen in town got dressed up to go to church, or the ranch hands slicked their hair back and put on their Sunday go-to-meeting duds to attend a dance in town, their fancy clothes were charcoal black, dull gray, or drab brown. This blonde-haired Eastern dandy's three-piece suit was bright baby blue, gold thread woven into his vest. As he disembarked from the Butterfield stagecoach, he placed a large, same-colored top hat on his head. The base of the hat was circled by a cream-colored silk sash. The striking stranger walked with a limp in his left leg, leaning on a silver dog-headed cane. But despite this impediment, or maybe because of it, he moved with impeccable posture and grace. The blue Bostonian removed a brush from his inside jacket pocket and began slowly and meticulously brushing the dust from his baby blue lapels and cuffs and shoulders. Color Mirabella impressed. With a quick glance up to Ernesto, her pleased expression said, "That's my brother Scott." Just as the little girl swallowed her spit and opened her mouth to greet her long-lost relative, another passenger emerged from the stagecoach. This one, too, was compellingly impressive, but in a completely different way. While the blonde-haired man was storybook-dashing and incredibly dignified, this new man was a devilishly handsome, roguish-looking, south-of-the-border-styled cowboy, with a thick snatch of fudge-colored hair that framed his face in a way that Mirabella could only describe as dreamy. This brunette cowboy's clothes weren't as fancy as the blonde passenger's, but they were just as colorful and, in their own right, just as snazzy. The dark-haired passenger wore a Latin-styled sangria red ruffled shirt with a brown leather short coat and black jeans with big silver studs down the pant leg. As he stepped out of the coach, he placed a short brown cowboy hat on his head, which functioned not to keep the sun out of his eyes, but to complement his killer look. After stretching his long silver-studded legs, the rough cowboy in the rouge-colored shirt sauntered over to Monty, the stagecoach driver, and asked in Spanish for him to toss down his saddle, which sat perched on top of the stage. Monty tossed the handcrafted saddle, heaving it by the horn over the side of the stagecoach roof. It fell heavy into the outstretched arms of the ruffled shirt stranger. The top-hatted dandy in baby blue inquired of Ramon, the shotgun-cradling second rider who sat next to Monty on top of the stagecoach, about his paisley-embroidered garment bag. Top Hat received the valise from the shotgun-riding Mexican and thanked him with a gringo-accented, "Gracias." Now both the little girl Mirabella and the little Mexican Ernesto showed confusion on their perplexed faces. Neither of them knew for sure which one to approach. The little 8-year-old gave a shoulder shrug and, thinking, "Oh well, here goes nothing," loudly cleared her throat to get the two handsome passengers' attention. "Mr. Lancer?" she inquired with a big question mark. The men answered in unison, Top Hat saying, "Yes," and Red Ruffles saying, "Yeah." Each man instinctively jerked toward the other, with an annoyed expression on his face. More confusion clouded the little girl's face, till she suddenly understood. "Oh my goodness," she exclaimed excitedly. "This is great! Both of you came together!" After the two men shared another uneasy glance at each other, the one with the top hat asked,